Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Thursday morning. It's January 15th. And what have we got here in Old Town Park City? Currently 26 degrees under mostly sunny skies. Heber City's reporting 22 degrees under some hazy sunshine. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Cedric Haynes. Good morning.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch back on this Thursday. Park City, we've got lots of sunshine heading your way again today. That ridge of high pressure anchored off the west coast is not budging, and that means our forecast will not change much. Temperatures will climb into the mid-40s for you for highs this afternoon in the Park City area. The Heber Valley, look for some of that inversion haze to stick around with us again for today. That'll keep temperatures in check for us as we go throughout the day, with those temperatures climbing into the upper 40s for highs. Again, hazy sunshine expected. As we move into your Friday, look for temperatures to drop down into the low 20s out there for you Friday morning. But Friday afternoon, you guessed it, lots of sunshine for us in Park City. Highs will climb into the low 40s. We'll see high temperatures in the mid-40s for us in the Heber Valley with more of that inversion haze. Now, we're tracking a weak wind shift that will hopefully, fingers crossed, give us a little bit of a break from the inversion haze as we get into the weekend. And it could bring us some very slightly cooler temperatures, but not really noticeable. We'll be looking at those temperatures dropping down into the teens heading into your Saturday morning. High temperatures Saturday afternoon will be in the low 40s in Park City with highs in the mid-40s in the Heber Valley. As we move into your Sunday, more sunshine is expected into the forecast. Again, temperatures starting off into the upper teens to low 20s. We'll see those highs in Park City in the mid-40s with highs in the upper 40s in the Heber Valley. Moving into your forecast for the beginning of next week, high pressure remains in charge, folks, at least for the first half of the week, so more sunshine is expected. Highs will be in the mid-40s in Park City on your Monday, upper 40s for your Heber Valley area, and then as we go into your Tuesday, expecting more sunshine to stick around, highs in the upper 40s with highs in the low 50s in the Heber Valley. And by your Wednesday, we're looking at sunshine, highs in the upper 40s in Park City with highs in the upper 40s to near 50 in the Heber Valley. There is a chance of a little bit of a pattern change by the end of next week, but that's still 7 to 9 days out. Let's look at the latest forecast for the Wasatch back on ABC 4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
And taking a look in the backcountry and the fun with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, it's Drew. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Leslie. You know, for avalanche concerns, they're really relegated to isolated terrain and the highest elevations, just some pockety, hard wind slabs that are going to be forming with the stronger winds, with this weak shortwave passing by the north, and then the isolated chance of triggering a deeper avalanche down to the ground, as was evidenced by the natural and upper stairs gulch of Big Cottonwood Canyon last weekend. So I think we're trending low. We won't just want to give it a couple more days, but again, just an isolated chance of triggering avalanches along the highest elevations elsewhere. The danger is generally low, and as always, you can get more information at utahavalanchecenter.org.
Okay, Drew, thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Stay tuned. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll be checking in with Summit County Council Member Megan McKenna with District 2, recapping yesterday's meeting. Utah Democratic Party Director Brian King with a preview of this year's legislative session, and film producer Lance Kramer talking about the film Holding Leon. That's screening for free on Sunday, January 18th at Park City Film at the Jim Santee Auditorium, and is shortlisted for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. Then stay tuned for Cool Science Radio. Today's guests include Michael Werner, University of Utah biology professor, talking about nematodes. These are tiny organisms that thrive inside the Great Salt Lake. Then renowned paleontologist Mark Whitten talking about one of the most famous and least understood dinosaurs of all time, Spinosaurus. All of that coming up on Cool Science Radio, of course, heard every Thursday from 9 to 10. Taking a look at some local news now at 8:10, another developer is launching the third effort to create a new town in Summit County in as many years. KPCW's Connor Thomas reports the town is planned in the Browns Canyon area.
Summit County planning staff say a developer has applied to form a town in the Browns Canyon area. Details are sparse. The Lieutenant Governor's office had not posted the application online as of midday January 14th, and it's unclear when it could be made available. Lieutenant Governor Deidre Henderson's staff did not immediately respond to KPCW's request for more information. Summit County Senior Planner Ray Milliner mentioned the application at the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission January 13th, although the town would be within the eastern Summit County Planning District.
A developer has made an application for a township in Browns Canyon with the governor's office. We were notified of that about a week ago. That could be thousands of units. We're not sure what it'll be.
The Browns Canyon area has seen incorporation attempts before. 5 years ago, a developer solicited resident interest in forming Garf Ranch City on 17,000 acres from Browns Canyon to Camas. It never followed through with a formal incorporation application. A few years before that, the Park Record reported that Promontory developer Francis Najafi applied to form a town on land owned by his LLC, South Point, Utah. South Point pulled its application, but still owns that land, located between the rail trail and Browns Canyon Road, near State Route 248. The most recent efforts to form towns elsewhere in Summit County have made it farther along in the process. That includes Dakota Pacific Real Estate's pending township in Kimball Junction, which it has framed as a backstop to ensure it can build its controversial mixed-use project there. Landowners west of Camas nearly got the would-be town of West Hills on the 2025 ballot, but other landowners blocked it in court. Now the parties are waiting to argue the case for a second time at the Utah Supreme Court before justices make their final ruling. Unlike West Hills, the Dakota Pacific town won't need people within its border to vote to incorporate. That's because it's governed under a different part of Utah incorporation law. It's not yet clear which type of town the one in Browns Canyon would be. That area is not densely populated. Nearly all of Browns Canyon is zoned for agriculture and one residential unit per 80 acres. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
Summit County Council met yesterday and then in the studio with a recap of the meeting. I have council member from District 2, Megan McKenna. Good morning, Megan.
Good morning, Leslie.
The council approved a resolution recommitting and expanding sustainability and climate change action goals for the county yesterday. You previously taught environmental science in your professional life. Can you maybe break down the climate threat or risk to us here locally?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're all seeing it this year. You know, as I look out the window here at the studio, the lack of snow is probably what we're feeling the most right now. I heard earlier on the radio, 2025 was another record-breaking year. I think Salt Lake had the hottest year on record last year. Water droughts, snowpack. I think this is all what we've projected. I remember sharing a study with my students that the snow line would be at 8,000 feet by 2030. And so this is where we are.
So the idea is to minimize impact, since the levers of power to reverse climate change probably don't exist at the local level. So how do we minimize economic impact? I mean, what's the next money-making industry besides skiing?
I mean, that's what, you know, we really need to look at more economic diversity within the community. But I think there's a lot of different options. And I think year-round tourism, I think tourism will continue to be a big driver in our area. But just like our chamber was looking at this year, different ways to engage visitors in the area when we don't have the snowpack that we have.
So what about some of the more cultural or emotional impacts? I mean, agriculture fading, the county certainly works to preserve it, but a lack of water could kill that too.
Yeah, that's a major concern, I think, for the entire West, which is why in a work session in the fall, when Emily Quinton and Megan Nick, our sustainability division, brought to us the idea of recommitting and expanding our goals. We were very supportive of that, and water is a big part of that, as we'll see in this legislative session too. Definitely something we're all concerned about.
So what have you heard about what's happening in this year's legislative session? I know the county council met with our state lawmakers recently.
Yeah, we held our annual legislative reception this earlier this week. And I think, you know, we're heading into the session next week. So still early, still lots unknown. Water will certainly be a big one on there. I know House Bill 76 is looking at requiring data centers to disclose water requirements prior to construction. That's one that we'll be looking at and seeing if our legislators put the Great Salt Lake ahead of data centers. That's certainly a big concern for all of us. Lots of issues, as always. We're looking at local land use authority, local governance, funding in the budget, how it impacts, you know, our strategic objectives. I think, you know, as a county, we're looking at growth management, regional planning, local housing choice, transportation, congestion, environmental stewardship, and so which bills will impact those. Lots of housing bills we're expected to see this year, with the governor's goal to increase starter homes. We'll likely see some changes there, allowing for more ADUs. I think that's a positive thing. But again, going back to that, the local land use authority, where there's already some revisions in House Bill 184 that we'll be following closely. Timelines for approval and the planning process. Energy bills, as you mentioned, House Bill 378 is concerning. That's looking at new fees on renewable energy. So, you know, going back to our sustainability goals, those we'll definitely be watching. Impacts on healthcare. I just heard about House Bill 88 the other day. That's a bill proposed by Trevor Lee. This one is very concerning. That would impact public health and specifically targeting our immigrant community and requiring citizenship for vaccine programs, food to pregnant women and children. This would impact our WIC and CHIP programs here at the state level. I could keep going on and on. I think one that the county is looking at House Bill 190, and this is one that our staff has helped to put together, and this would allow employers really to take a bigger role in childcare, and this is the tax credits for employers that provide childcare subsidies. So this would be a state match. That's one that we're hopeful comes out.
Back to House Bill 184, as you mentioned, a land use bill. What did that do?
I don't know the details on that, and like I said, it's still really early. But that was some provisions on land use. I think mostly looking at the timeline and the process for approval, and I think they're looking to streamline approvals there.
Yeah, and it's usually those land use bills that we see like the last few days of a session, so we don't know what's up somebody's sleeve.
Mm-hmm.
Back to the sustainability goals, it looks like perhaps the most actionable goal for the county would be to move to renewable energy sources locally. We heard that from County Manager Shane Scott Tuesday that we didn't meet the 2020 goal. So what do we need to do to kind of catch up here?
We did meet most of our goals. I think you're probably referring to the transportation fleet. That was one of the goals that we didn't meet, and that goal was modified. And actually, Emily Quinton clarified that one for me last night. It was really a matter of just our transportation fleet doesn't turn over as quickly. So just looking at the dates on that. And so now going forward, electric and hybrid transportation fleet vehicles are the first choice. I think renewable energy is something we definitely support. When we looked at we talked about, I think it was the last time I was on, the renewable community, Utah Renewable Communities, and what we're trying to do there. I think this was really exciting. I think we were all really happy with how this resolution came out. As you mentioned, I taught AP Environmental Science at the high school, and teaching it's a really hard job. And the hardest part for me, though, was really knowing And being the adult in the classroom and just knowing that we're not doing enough for young people and future generations to provide a livable planet and healthy, clean air and water. And so anything that we can do on the local level, I think is something that all of us and Summit County residents really can get behind and support. So this is really exciting to expand our goals and to add a few new ones, including waste and diverting waste from our landfill, which will go hand in hand with our new solid waste master plan. Adding some the water goals we will go in line with the new part of our general plan that addresses water conservation. And so this is, something that we're really proud of. You know, I was listening to the radio earlier, as I mentioned, and, 2.4% greenhouse gases rose last year. And so I think anything that we can do to show our young people that we're trying, I think, goes a long way.
And wanted to also bring up the fact, I know that the county has put solar panels on several of its buildings. Are there other buildings that need to be added to?
I think that's definitely part of our goal as we transition. You know, the Electron Solar Project was a big part of getting most of our energy from renewable sources, and anything I think that we can do locally going forward that we would be happy to support.
Okay, so they were approved, and it looks like we're going to get back to them in 3 years as opposed to waiting the 6 years that we did.
Yeah, that was another change to review every 3 years, mm-hmm. And I think that's appropriate.
All right. The county issuing up to $99 million in bonds that the council authorized last year. Can you remind the public what the money will be used for?
So this is came out of last year's legislative session, and it's the impacted community sales tax. And this really goes to public infrastructure improvements, primarily for transportation projects. And this was a resolution that we authorized in November. And so this, the resolution last night was really just this preliminary official statement that just approves the sale of these bonds from the resort community sales tax.
Okay, and we know that some of the money will be used for the bus rapid transit lanes. I mean, is the chunk of it going to fix 224 as a result of the Dakota Pacific agreement?
That'll be part of it. Yeah, I think that's definitely going to be a big one. But we have a lot of transportation issues. But I think many will come out of the Kimball Junction area and BRT, as you mentioned.
The county staff report said that there will be $89 million in bonds, not the full $99 million. Any discussion about why you're holding off $10 million?
I think the 99 was just kind of the cap that was, set. I think they didn't need to do the full amount, but that was just what we were allotted.
Okay. You mentioned that you were at the Summit County Board of Health meeting on Monday. What were the conversations there now that we have a measles case confirmed here in Summit County?
Yeah, and actually our meeting on Monday was a closed session. It was really for personnel, that was part of the review process for our Board of Health, our Health Department Director, Phil Bondurant. But we were briefed over the weekend on the measles case that was identified in the county. And I did mention last night, just really appreciate the health department and their continued professionalism and excellent communication. It's really unfortunate that we have a case in the county, but I have all the confidence in our team and that we're following the protocols, and just really grateful that all the work that went in ahead of time so that when this happened, we were ready to respond.
And the Community Health Improvement Plan is out. That's the program created by the Health Department every 5 years. Have you reviewed it yet? And I guess if so, what stands out?
Yeah, this is really exciting. I have reviewed it, and actually our entire Board of Health was part of this process. We had a two-day work session last fall, along with several other organizations and stakeholders and community members to help put the Community Health Improvement Plan. That's the CHIP. It's a five-year plan. It's data-driven based on the community health assessment and other data that we've collected, and will really help kind of drive this the next 5 years in terms of public health in the county. Some of the priorities that were identified, it was really interesting to be part of that process, and I think you know, the three priority areas: strengthening partnerships, improving food and nutrition access, and increasing immunization coverage to reduce preventable disease are really key priorities. You know, as we just talked about with the measles case in the county, I think that's an important one for us to address. But really, it's a great resource for the entire county that will help guide these next 5 years. I would encourage everyone to take a look at it. It's was on the agenda last night, but also on the Health Department website. And you can follow along progress as we go. There'll be a dashboard to show how we're doing and where we're headed next.
Okay. Let's see. The county honored poll workers yesterday. I'm guessing. I mean, why? And how were they? How were they honored?
Yes, this was also really exciting. I was not aware, but January 27th is Help America Vote Day. And Eve First and our county clerk and her office really wanted to recognize all of the poll workers that help administer safe and secure elections here in Summit County and protect our local democracy. And really two families in particular that have just done a tremendous job with our local elections. Linda and Rich Dolan and Renata and Gary Dalton have just donated a lot of time and energy to our local elections, and we felt it was important they be recognized, and that we encourage other community members to help America vote. So that's coming up January 27th.
Okay, Megan, anything else?
You know, I'd just like to say, Leslie, that these are challenging times in our community, in our state, in the country. We are very divided. If you follow the news, breaking news every day, it's certainly a challenging time. And so I would just encourage folks to, as our sheriff would say, if you see something, say something. Support our community and help each other get through this this challenging time.
Okay. Megan McKenna, Summit County Councilmember for District 2. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the 2026 Utah legislative session starts Tuesday with another 45-day session on the Hill. On the phone is former state lawmaker and now chairman of the Utah Democratic Party, Brian King. Good morning, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. Great to be with you.
Yeah, so before we get into some of the legislative issues for Democrats this year, let's talk about the success Democrats have had recruiting candidates for this year's elections. A press release says that the numbers are historic. So what are those numbers?
Yeah, well, one of the things that we want to make sure that we do as Democrats is give people across the state a choice. And too often in the past, we've had circumstances where, especially in really red parts of the state, really conservative parts of the state, many times in rural sections of the state, we haven't had candidates with Democrats as the label behind their names willing to step up and be a choice, an alternative for people. And we worked really hard to get great candidates across the state in place running not just in along the Wasatch Front and the Wasatch Back, but making sure that they were in locations across the state in rural areas. And we ended up having about 90% of the seats at the legislative and congressional level and school board, state school board level filled with candidates. And we were really thrilled with that. We worked hard to make sure we got good candidates, and we were successful. In the past, we've oftentimes fallen quite a bit shorter than that. We've ended up with 55, 60, 65% of the seats being contested, and we're contesting a much higher percentage of those races now.
Yeah, so why the interest now and not years before this?
Oh, we've had an interest in years before. It's just tough to recruit candidates in some of those areas. And I think people are stepping up. I just heard your last guest talk about what troubled times we face. We are in really disconcerting political times, not just on the national level. Of course, that's obvious in many ways, but at the state level, too. We've had our leadership ignore the will of the people, this whole drive to put on the ballot Prop 4, the anti-gerrymandering initiative. That's something that, I don't know whether that's going to end up on the ballot in November or not. In some ways, I think it would be a good thing to be on the ballot simply because I think it would really bring people out to say we support Prop 4. We don't want our districts gerrymandered. But the fact that there would be so much effort put into doing that at all by the Republican leadership in the legislature and in our state government makes me think, my goodness, these are folks that are really out of touch with the feelings and the values and the priorities of Utahns. So yeah, I think we're seeing people get more excited about standing up and saying, look, I want an alternative to the supermajority control that we've seen here in Utah for decades. And we look at, we don't think monopolies are good in markets or economic terms, would say a monopoly is a terrible thing. Why in the world are we so complacent about putting up with a monopoly in our politics?
Power. But Democrats historically get trounced on by Republicans. I mean, like a 30-70 split. I mean, why? I guess, how did you convince them to run? I mean, and when they are really kind of subjecting themselves to defeat.
Yeah, well, there's greater hope that they're not subjecting themselves to defeat. Let me give you an example. HD4, which is up in Summit County and Morgan County, that area, we've got a great candidate, Zane Wilson-Hume, who threw his hat in the ring, former mayor of Oakley. I mean, my goodness, Zane is a seasoned veteran in politics and business and has lived in the community for many, many years. What would cause him to throw his hat in? Because he's so concerned about what he's seeing at the state level and at the county level. I'm so frustrated with the legislature. We had this HB 356 pass that targeted Summit County in terms of saying we're not going to let you do at-large district-based elections for your county council. We're going to change it so that we basically at the legislature put our thumb on the scale to ensure that Republicans have a more even chance. They don't do that. The legislature did that, just as you mentioned earlier, for power purposes. And I think that things like that cause people, really respectable and longstanding citizens in Summit County, to stand up and say, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to run as a Democrat. And that's exactly what Mayor Wilson-Hume is doing.
Yeah. Now, so is the party going to be providing more funding for these candidates to run a campaign, more training?
Certainly more training, more resources. We don't generally, as a party, give a lot of money directly to candidates, but we can help in many ways by providing them the resources to get their campaigns off the ground. We've got a little package of information and materials that we provide candidates to, for example, help set up a website, make sure that they have discounts available to them for lawn signs and literature, things like that. So there are financial and other resources. We've got a great database that we make available to people in terms of knowing who's in their district and knowing what doors they should knock on to ensure that they reach the people that they want to reach. So there are a lot of ways in which the state party is helping and can help.
All right. Well, looking forward to this 2026 election cycle, I guess what would success look like for Utah Democrats in terms of, seats?
Yeah. Well, right now we've got in the state legislature, we have 22 seats out of 104 that are sitting legislators. So you can see we're right around 20%. the goal is to break the supermajority. If you can break the supermajority by getting a third of the seats in your hands, you can prevent the majority from suspending the rules and prevent them from playing games and pulling tricks out of their pocket to accomplish things that are really not a reflection of the will of the people. So that would put some better guardrails on the power that they're currently abusing too much of the time. So we're working on that. It would take getting about 12 seats in the House, and it would take about 5 seats in the Senate. So we think we can do that. We've got candidates that allow us to do that, and I think Utahns are looking for a different way. They're looking for a check on abuse of power, and we certainly need that here in Utah as well as across the country.
So moving on to this year's legislative session, of course, you served in the Utah legislature for years. You missing it at all?
I've had people ask me that. A little bit. I mean, you know, it's fun to be in the room where it happens. It's fun to be involved and have real personal firsthand knowledge about some of the issues. But on the other hand, it's extraordinarily stressful, Leslie. And so on the whole, I like the position that I'm in now. I still, of course, am close to the political happenings in Utah, and it's fun. But I don't have the stress that I used to have in the legislature.
All right. Well, we know the budget is essentially flat, about $30.7 billion, down from $30.8 last year. What does that mean for lawmakers as they work to approve a budget?
Well, I'll tell you one thing I think it means, and I think my Democratic colleagues agree with me. It means you shouldn't be looking at more tax decreases, tax cuts. The Republicans are very fond of cutting taxes because they want government to be as easily managed as possible, and they don't want it, and they don't want to have the government involved in our daily affairs in a way that is meaningful and helpful. They just want to be free to do what they want to do. The problem with cutting income taxes, which is what they're talking about, is that money is earmarked for public and higher education and for the needs of children and people with disabilities. So that's where the cuts are going to have the greatest impact. That frustrates me, and I think I speak for all Democrats in saying it's not the right priorities for the state right now.
What are the top three issues you see energizing Utah voters across the state right now?
Oh, home prices are, you know, the cost of getting a home, the cost of finding a shelter is just outrageous. And, of course, this is true across the country, but it's certainly true in Utah. I think that public lands, of course, is a critically important issue. You hear a lot about that. We see some of our conservative friends across the aisle at the federal and the state level trying to take action to move public lands from public hands into private hands. And if that happens, you're going to see those public lands taken off the board, and we will not have access to them in a way that's very troubling to me. And then finally, people can disagree about what the top three are, but I think one of the things we've got to be looking at and taking a harder, taking better action and measures to address is the Great Salt Lake. Great Salt Lake is shrinking, and we're in the middle of another dry winter. We, of course, go in cycles of wetness and dry winters, but this winter is a bad one. And it, of course, impacts Summit in the sense of the ski resorts. I mean, climate change is real. I wish we could have more people at the legislature explicitly acknowledge that and take specific action to address how we keep the Great Salt Lake healthy and how we ensure that Utah and its economy, to the greatest extent possible, the stuff that goes on up in Summit County in terms of tourism and skiing, that we keep that healthy, too.
Yeah. And I think home prices and, you know, affordable housing may be an area where we can see some bipartisan cooperation, but not at the level that we're seeing it here in Summit County when we're, like, forced to approve development that has some affordable housing in it. So how do we get around that?
Yeah, no, the politics, they say, is the art of the possible. And there have to be compromises made. There have to be people who make sacrifices and groups that are called on to lose the battle in terms of what negotiations take place and what adjustments occur to reach a certain point that everyone says they want to reach. when you're talking about affordable homes, there are some people, we deal with it down here in the Valley in terms of alternative dwelling units. I don't know off the top of my head how big an issue that is in Summit, but down here, I mean, there are some people that really want to have loosened restrictions on being able to move a mother-in-law or a grandmother or a family member into an alternative dwelling unit, but it's controversial. And so if you want to make progress, you're going to have some people who recognize, well, we're not going to get exactly what we want. And that's just the nature of living in our society, a complex society that requires some people have to give a little more than they want. And look, it's this whole NIMBY versus YIMBY approach, right? Yes, in my backyard, or no, not in my backyard. And your attitude about how willing you are to make accommodations, to live peaceably, and improve the quality of life in our society where people have different interests, that's the test of how effective we are as a society. And right now, of course, we're dealing with that on a lot of different fronts.
Mm-hmm. Something else, I guess, with regard to the Great Salt Lake, how's the Democratic Party kind of positioning itself around that? I mean, do you have any solutions?
Oh, it's a complex problem, and I wouldn't say that the Democratic Party has solutions so much as we have contributions about what can be done to ensure that water gets to that lake. There, what we need to do is identify the problem in terms of where the water is used and take effective measures to address that. We've got proposals for putting better incentives in place for individuals using water for agriculture to refrain from that use and allow that water to get to the lake. We've got development involving some of these huge data processing centers, the AI centers that want to come to Utah. The governor wants to bring them in, but they're incredibly intensive in their use of water. They've gotten a lot more efficient and effective in the last few years, but boy, this NSA, National Security Agency Center out in Bluffdale, uses an enormous amount of water. Maybe going forward we can reduce that, but we need to have some, this is a multi-front discussion, and there are many, many, many things that need to be put on the table and discussed in order to make sure Great Salt Lake gets the water that it needs.
Yeah, and then some of the early discussions I'm reading about the expansion of the state Supreme Court. Is that something Democrats could get behind?
Yeah, I'll tell you, that concerns me a great deal. I'm a lawyer in my real life, and Utah has always had one of the state judiciaries, that was a model for other states across the country. We don't elect our judges. We have a commission that selected individuals who applied for these judicial positions, and that commission was nonpartisan, and they made recommendations to the governor, who then appointed. We've been moving in the direction of making that whole process much more partisan. Right now, it's the governor who appoints all the members of that commission. It used to be that the commission was appointed by the leadership of the Utah State Bar in association with the governor. Now it's the governor's choice alone. So what we see is frustration on the part of our supermajority leaders that some of the key rulings that we've seen from the Utah Supreme Court in the last year or two have gone against them, as their political interests lie, and they're frustrated and they're angry, and they're trying to basically, in slow motion, not immediately in just one fell swoop, but they're trying in slow motion to pack the court, to increase the number of justices on the Utah Supreme Court, who will then, they think, reflect their personal, the supermajority's will. And it's very frustrating because it decreases the quality of the court. We've had a great court. Every one of those justices that have issued the decisions that the supermajority is unhappy with were appointed by Republican governors and approved by a Republican state Senate. And yet, you know, when things don't go their way, the supermajority's way, they get cranky and they say, okay, we'll fix this. We'll fix your wagon, judiciary, by putting more justices on the Supreme Court that we like. Well, that's something Democrats oppose.
Okay. Brian, I'm out of time. I got to leave it at that, but I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for calling, Leslie. It's always fun to talk to you.
That's the chair of the Utah Democratic Party, Brian King. Again, state legislative session starts on Tuesday, day after the Martin Luther King holiday. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Park City Film is changing up its schedule a bit this weekend in order to show the documentary Holding Leah this Sunday in the Santee Auditorium. The film has been shortlisted for an Academy Award for Best Documentary. On the phone to tell us more about it is one of the producers, Lance Kramer. Good morning, Lance. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So start by telling us about the film, Holding Leah. What is it about?
Sure. So the film is actually about my relatives. First of all, also related to the director of the film, who's my brother. So it's our relatives, Liat and her family, are the central protagonists of the film. Liat and her husband, Aviv, were kidnapped on October 7th, 2023, and subsequently taken to Gaza. And we, as relatives of the family, decided together with her parents and her sister, and her kids, to document the family's experience navigating the crisis in the immediate aftermath of October 7th. And so the film is a very kind of intimate portrayal and representation of how a family navigates a situation like this, and how each person in the family had their own political and emotional responses to what had happened, and how they had to kind of navigate each other's differences as they went through this together as a family.
All right. So Liat and her family, her mom and dad, living in Israel, but my understanding is that they are Israeli American. So what brought them to Israel?
Yeah. So Liat's parents moved to Israel about 5 decades ago. They were part of a youth socialist movement that they grew up in. Philly and New Jersey area, and then moved to Israel in the 70s. They lived on a kibbutz. They initially moved to a kibbutz in the northern part of the country. Liat subsequently raised her family in a kibbutz in the south, which is where she was kidnapped from. But they were part of a kind of progressive movement back in the 70s that was envisioning in a sense, shared state between Israelis and Palestinians. And obviously we know the direction that things have gone since then. Some of the family members that moved to Israel at that time were so upset by the direction things were moving in that they left and went back to the U.S. But Yehuda and Chaya and then Liat and Aviv stayed and have lived their lives there.
All right. So you and your brother, however, live in the States, yeah?
I'm American. I'm not Israeli. I'm Jewish. But I live in Washington, D.C., and my brother does as well. And one of the many wild things about the situation was that even though this conflict was playing out thousands of miles away from us in D.C., Yehuda and Chaya and Liat's son and sister came to D.C. in the midst of all this because they are all American Israeli dual citizens. And we're not getting much of a response from the Israeli government, but they were getting a lot of activity and engagement from the Americans. So they wound up coming to D.C. to try and get support from the American government in the midst of all this. And a lot of the film actually takes place in D.C. In those kinds of spaces where they were trying to navigate American political spaces and media special interest to try and get some support.
Yeah, and that was really, I got that kind of difficult to hear Liat's father talk about how Benjamin Netanyahu's goal was not to save the people and the hostages, but to forward his agenda. I mean, you're not Israeli, but I mean, can you give us a sense? I mean, is that what most Israelis were thinking?
Well, you know, I can't speak for all Israelis, certainly not as an Israeli, or not even begin to kind of unpack the whole country. But what I can say is that, you know, they as a family, and her father in particular, felt very strongly that the family was not being prioritized. The family's interests and just experience was not being prioritized. They often felt like a kind of pawn in a bigger game. And also, perhaps most importantly, Yehuda felt very strongly that to honor his daughter's values in this situation, he wanted to make sure that her captivity and his son-in-law's captivity was not used as a justification to inflict any further violence on Palestinians or Israelis or anyone. And he was deeply concerned that that was the direction things were going in, which is why he felt so compelled to speak up. Not everyone in the family agreed with him. In fact, there was stark disagreement. So also those kinds of contentions within the family felt very, very important for us to be able to chronicle, because here in front of our camera, you saw three generations of a family navigating their differences and also holding love for each other. And just in this polarized, divisive environment, we feel like there's a real lack of being able to see examples of people still connecting even amidst their differences.
Yeah, and I was gonna note that the film does reflect on the conflicting perspectives within the family, and why was it important to the filmmakers to include those internal differences rather than presenting a single narrative, a unified narrative?
Yeah, I mean, the frame of the film at the end of the day is the story of a family. Yes, it's set amidst this hostage crisis, which is an extraordinary situation and a war, you know, which I hope no one ever has to live through, but sadly people do live through situations like that. But not all of us do, but most of us are part of a family in some shape or form and can relate to that kind of dynamic. And what we felt that we were witnessing, both as members of the family, but even also as filmmakers, was that we were seeing how a family unit was navigating this extraordinary situation. And those kinds of internal conflicts, a lot of times where you blur the personal and political, or where is the line between the personal and political, is really hard to identify. And, you know, a father upset with his daughter, or a husband and wife in an argument at 3 a.m. These are kind of situations that we just felt could be relatable no matter who you are, what your background is, or what kinds of experiences you had. And we felt that that kind of opportunity for empathy and connection was really important.
Yeah. So did you realize, I guess, did your relationship with Liat, being a relative, somehow shape the approach that you took to the film?
For sure. We wouldn't have been able to make this film had we not had that relationship with the family prior, because there was no kind of pre-production or development period after, you know, before this happened. It was October 7th happened, and within about 2 weeks, we were beginning to film. So we had to have that bedrock of trust built in order to start that rapidly. That was the case with the rest of the family, because we were filming with them while Liat was held as a hostage. But she obviously didn't know about the film while she was in Khan Yunis. When she came out and was returned, then we had to have very rapid conversations with Liat about what we had been doing for the prior 54 days and what we hope to do moving forward. And Liat is an extraordinary person, and right away she understood the magnitude and the importance of what we were doing with the film and documenting what was becoming history. And she was on board right away. And I think that that would have been a harder thing if we had been strangers, so to speak. But what she did say was that she was very clear with us that, I believe in the film, I want to be a part of it, but my only requirement is that I not be put in a box, and that I have the space to represent myself, and I don't want to be kind of just pegged or seen as just a hostage. I want to be myself. And that was an important commitment that we made to her, was to just put no requirements on her, but to just let her be her true self.
Yeah. How soon after the October 7th attack did you find yourself on the ground there making the film?
Within weeks. It was right away. Not right away, so in a sense we weren't there that day, and not the immediate days after, but within weeks. And hopefully you kind of see that play out, that, you know, this is, I think we start about 2 weeks after the film. So there's no actual material in the film of October 7th. We weren't filming there. We weren't there. But the film really starts kind of when we started filming.
Yeah. And the film made under extraordinarily difficult and evolving circumstances. I guess, what was sort of the biggest challenge you faced while filming in real time?
Well, for one, I mean, it's what you're saying, is that we didn't know what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So So every day, in some cases every minute, we just didn't know what was going to unfold. So we had to be prepared for kind of a myriad of different potential outcomes. Obviously, throughout the whole time, we were hoping that Liat and Aviv would survive, but we didn't know whether they would survive. So that was the big question hanging over our heads. And there were kind of thousands of micro questions, like specific example, as you'll see towards the end of the film, as the family are getting kind of these 2, 3 a.m. phone calls, you know, from the IDF to tell the family whether Liat is on the list of hostages to come home when there was a ceasefire agreement. To film a moment like that, Brandon, my brother, and Yoni Brook, our director of photography, were sleeping outside of Yehuda and Chaya's hotel room, and they had basically put like sheets and a pillow in the hallway, and were sleeping in the hallway to make sure that when they got that phone call, Yehuda could open the door and they could slide in to record the phone call. And there were just kind of countless situations like that where we just had to be very present no matter what. And that's when we were filming. And then there was, you know, for every hour that we were filming, there were probably 8 hours where we were not filming, just trying to be with the family and be supportive and, you know, try to be there for them. It was very, very hard. Not to mention the backdrop of the political situation and just navigating the polarity and the fear and trying to still just show up and film amidst all these very heated and kind of painful spaces we were in.
Well, it's going to be a week from today where we hear the nominations for the Oscars announced. As I mentioned, this is kind of shortlisted. Best of luck with the film. I'm just about out of time, but I just wanted to give you an opportunity. Anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be here talking with you about the film. We're so excited to share the film with Park City. Love being able to come to Park City, and I always love connecting with people there. You know, if you want to find out more information about the film, the social media handle is @HoldingLiat. It's holdingliat.com. We're opening this weekend also in Los Angeles at the Lemley Theaters. We just opened last week in New York with the Film Forum, which is also playing the voice of Hinder Jab together, which we've been very proud to be playing together with their film. And we're going to be opening in about 20 cities nationwide over the next couple weeks. It's an independent release, which means we're doing it ourselves.
Okay.
And we hope you can come support it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Again, the screening of Holding Liat being held Sunday, January 8th, 6 p.m. at Park City Film in the Jim Santee Auditorium. Admission is free. It's recommended that you register.